Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. A great show tonight. This tonight's show will be the first part of a discussion between the three movie geeks, myself, Jerry, and Dean, where we all discuss five of our favorite filmmakers. And then we'll have a roundtable discussion about the intricacies of their work. But just to be clear, I mean, I'm sure among all of us that we have many, many favorite filmmakers.
Yeah.
So these are five amongst our favorite filmmakers. These
aren't
a definitive five, I'm sure, for all of us. You know. So we did a coin toss backstage, and as everyone knows, all coins have three sides. Jerry, I want to know your one of your picks.
One of my picks, I want to just get this one out of the way, I guess. Let's just say Quentin Tarantino, because everyone knows I'm going to say it, so I'm going to say it. There. Okay. Now, having
I knew we'd have an opportunity to discuss Tarantino tonight, and I was looking
forward
to it.
Now, there you go. You're going to get it. You're going to get it, because I want to get that out of the way earlier. And why? I'd honestly have to say there are years where if I do go back and watch something, it's usually one of his films. I won't lie to you. On Christmas, Stars on Christmas Day in 2005 had all his films on, and I just sat and watched the TV all day. Just watched every film one after the other. So that would go up to Kill Bill Volume 2 at that time, I think. You know, what I like about his films, I was like, wow, here's what I like about Reservoir Dogs when I first saw it, and I guess that was, God, that was 20 years ago. When Reservoir Dogs came out, I had a friend of mine that was out in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
He had actually seen it. He said, have you seen this thing called Reservoir Dogs? This is ridiculously good. This guy is amazing. When you first heard of Reservoir Dogs, what was your immediate reaction? Like, you know, was it like, I've got to see this? Or
I got to see it. And then it wasn't playing after a week. It played for a week. And then it disappeared, and then it came back and played a couple weeks later and disappeared. And then it came back, and I went down to see it when we had this big blizzard in 93. I was just like, I wanted to originally go see that and a double feature of that and Bad Lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
My friend was like,
We're
not doing both movies. We do one or the other. I said, all right, we'll do Reservoir Dogs. And, you know, and I was like watching. I'm like, wow, this is a guy who thinks like me. This is very disturbing. This is a guy who really has a, like, really pop culture but very violent sensibility. But it was just like, wow. I've never seen anything like this in a sense. I've never seen someone articulate their vision. Just in the dialogue, obviously, is the first thing that pops to mind. But now I could say that about two other directors, too, Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach. Wow. These guys think in a way like I do. This is very frightening.
I definitely feel that same way about Baumbach.
Yeah, Baumbach scares me how much the similarities. It's just like with, you know, just my own personality.
Well, with Baumbach in particular, with Greenberg, I just felt like he was just peering into my own soul. It was craziness, but back to Tarantino, like with when you heard the title Reservoir Dogs, did it just like, okay, now what is this? Because that's what I felt. I was like, Reservoir Dogs?
Yeah.
What a crazy title that is.
I didn't get the connection, even though he would say it over and over in interviews and everything. It was how he mispronounced the, what's his name? What's the director's name? The first director's name? That for the Last Infants? The one married to Candace Bergen?
Louis Malle.
And he couldn't pronounce it. He couldn't pronounce the name of the movie. It was his favorite movie. He couldn't pronounce it when he worked with the video archives, and that's where I guess the name comes from.
Because
you always say Reservoir.
Okay. Au revoir, l'enfant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
And he could not pronounce it, and it's interesting. But here's a guy who, let me ask you, he had four biographies come out immediately, like right after Pulp Fiction came out, you know.
Well, yeah, the Tarantino mystique was born.
Pulp Fiction.
it was really the start of the kind of the fan director movement.
I mean,
the people that just had these movies coursing through their veins,
mm-hmm.
and of course, previous generations like Scorsese, you could say the same thing. But what differentiated this generation, Tarantino's generation, our generation,
right.
is the fact that we could access these movies at any time. And so we experienced and lived with them in a different way. And the older generation of filmmakers, some of them say that's not necessarily a good thing because we had these movies and experiences stored in our memories mm-hmm. for many years because we could not revisit them.
For those of us who grew up in the 70s, we'd have to wait for movies to be released or they come on TV, mm-hmm. which was a very painstaking process. I don't know how kids today, they don't know how good they have it.
But when I was your age, I just said that.
Yeah.
I had to walk to the movie theater barefoot in the snow.
I did that at least once.
I mean, Reservoir Dogs, it sounds like an art film title. You know, it sounds like it could be a snuffy film. I do recall catching Reservoir Dogs on home video,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's really where it caught fire. I mean, when it came out in theaters, there was a buzz about Tarantino and this original voice, but I think it really caught fire on video. And then when Pulp Fiction premiered at Cannes,
mm-hmm.
I remember reading the reviews in The Hollywood Reporter and Variety the morning after the premiere
mm-hmm.
in Cannes. I was very interested in it. And I couldn't wait to see it. And I recalled seeing it for the first time. I was working at the theater around that time, and we got a print of it. So mm-hmm. I had to screen the print to make sure it was okay before we showed it to the public. So I sat there and watched it. I was by myself in that theater watching Pulp Fiction for the first time. And it truly was like discovering what I absolutely knew would be a cultural phenomenon before
mm-hmm.
before anyone else had really caught on, and I thought I at one point in the hypodermic scene, I remember I had to stand up and pace. It made me so on edge, and you forget that reaction because when it becomes such a part of pop culture, you forget that initial visceral reaction you had to it. It kind of dims over time. So I revisited Pulp Fiction a couple of months ago for the first time since it was out in theaters.
Right.
And it brought back what a truly terrific experience that film
was. Right,
is.
Yeah.
All right, hurry up, man. Here, I'll tell you what to do. No, man, you're going to give it a shot.
I ain't giving it a shot before either,
all right? I ain't starting now. Look, you brought it here, and that means that you're going to give it a shot. The day that I bring an ODM bitch to your house, then I give it a shot. Give it a shot.
Give it.
Here.
Give me that. All right, tell me what to do.
Okay, you're giving her an injection of adrenaline straight to her heart, but she's got a breastplate. You got to pierce through that. So what you got to do is you got to bring the needle down in a stabbing motion.
I got to stab her three times?
No, you don't got to fucking stab her three times. You got to stab her once, but it's got to be hard enough to get through her breastplate into her heart, all right? And then once you do that, you press down on the plunger.
Okay, then what happens?
I'm curious about that myself.
It's Eno's fucking joke, man. Am I going to kill her?
No, she's supposed to come out of it like that. It's...
All right, count to three.
All right, ready? One. Two.
Three!
I have a little story to tell about watching Pulp Fiction for the first time. I went to a downtown theater, which is now closed, downtown in Atlanta, and it was kind of a rare thing for me to go out and be so excited about a movie, because I had seen Reservoir Dogs in the theaters, and I loved it. But I knew that there was something else that this filmmaker could offer. Because Reservoir Dogs, finally, is kind of a movie. It's kind of a movie that's kind of claustrophobic and set in one place. And it's
right.
And its budget, it's low budget while well used.
Oh, yeah.
Also, it sort of lets you know that this is a first-time film by a very good filmmaker immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And you immediately know that it's not just about the violence, which is easy to exploit, Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's also about the humor and the characters involved in the movie. There's a lot of humor in Reservoir Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, as we all did, I love that movie. So I made it a point the first day of Pulp Fiction, and I think this must have been after it won at Cannes Film Festival won the Palme d'Or at Cannes Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I've got to go see this the first day. I don't know why, but I had to go and do it. So I went downtown to a theater there, and there was nobody in the theater except for two other people. And you know how it begins with that, you know, the definitions of pulp and fiction
mm-hmm.
on the screen. Well, immediately it came up, that definition came up, and the film burned.
Mm. Oh, man.
It just blew up, and so it just burned. It was like, it was so incendiary that it just had to burn, you know. So
oh,
I was
God.
Like, oh, wow, my gosh, it just, okay, so this is weird. So we waited for a minute, and it started up, and just that experience of having it burn immediately was just like, it just made the excitement of seeing it even greater. My heart was pounding all the way through that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was out of hand.
Right.
Well, that's just it, and I think that's what's special about Tarantino's films.
Yeah.
Because they are surprising, and they're unpredictable, and in a special way, in so much so that when I see a Tarantino film, I walk out of it, and I feel like I've discovered the joy of movies again for the first
yes.
time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really
like that.
And some of these movies I haven't revisited Kill Bill 1 or 2 since they were out in the theaters. But and I wasn't necessarily excited about seeing them beyond the involvement of Tarantino. But I had the same reaction walking out of both of those movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt lifted up, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like you're walking on a cloud
How I felt. Like before Kill Bill Volume 1 and everything, I had been, I can't say I was dying to see it. And you're watching it, and you're just like, oh my God, this is just so much fun. This is why we go to the movies. It's something so cathartic. It's energetic. I mean, dare I say, giddy almost when you walk out of both of those films. And especially after Inglourious Basterds, you feel, or True Romance, which he did not direct, which the late Tony Scott directed. You feel very, there's this giddiness that I can only say I feel after watching a Paul Thomas Anderson film.
The story goes, I mean, people think that Reservoir Dogs hit it big and then Tony Scott picked up True Romance. But Tony Scott had the choice, Tarantino gave him the choice, you could either direct Reservoir Dogs or True Romance,
mm-hmm.
and I'll direct the other. And Tony Scott chose True Romance.
Right.
I mean, that's how that happened.
I just rewatched True Romance just in the past couple of weeks, post Tony Scott's death. And I'm amazed by True Romance, how much it has so much of Tarantino's voice in it.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a Tarantino movie, really.
Mm-hmm.
Just if you were gonna throw that into the mix with all of his other movies and tell somebody who had never seen a Tarantino movie, pick the one movie out of here that's not directed by Tarantino, it would be quite difficult, actually.
Well, I think probably that's due to the major factor that distinguishes Tarantino's work, which is his writing. I mean, his voice
mm-hmm.
is unmistakable. I mean, it's
right.
the same on another end of the spectrum as Aaron Sorkin. You hear a Sorkin
mm-hmm.
Sorkin conversation, and you know that's Aaron Sorkin.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I do think that as the years have gone by and his career has matured, that he
mm-hmm.
has gained a definite, stronger sense of visual.
Right.
Than he had
yeah.
at the beginning of his career. He's the total package now. I mean, he's as much a visual storyteller as a storyteller of dialogue.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And dialogue is very difficult. I mean, he did an outstanding job in Reservoir Dogs because the dialogue is very difficult to use as the driving force of a film. I mean, it's different in a play, of course. But a film, you know, it's a visual medium.
That's right.
Okay. Dean, let's hear one of yours.
Well, I would like to start out, you know, and I have to say, you know, I agonized over this list. I said, how am I going to do this? You know, am I just going to pick the real top five? You know, they're going to be the same, you know, am I going to pick the same people that, you know, a lot of people would pick? And I decided immediately that I wasn't going to do that. And I felt like I wanted to keep it surprising for people. Going to my first choice, it's an unusual choice, but I feel very strongly about it. It's somebody who's not really known as a director unto himself, although he is an Oscar winner. But my first choice is Saul Bass.
Oh.
Saul Bass, to me, epitomizes the sort of, the kind of the plastic nature of movies. You know, Saul Bass is a designer by nature.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he's most known as the designer of, almost 100 title sequences, starting from 1954 up until, you know, 1998. And I love Saul Bass because he is somebody that you can feel his love of the visual immediately. And I love the fact that he is working in cahoots with other filmmakers to try and capitulate their movies into sometimes 3-minute sequences, you know, that are beginning their movies, you know. So if you think about Saul Bass, he worked with Preminger, Hitchcock, Kubrick, Scorsese, and so many other directors in between. I mean, even like James L. Brooks or John Frankenheimer, his credit sequences really changed movies in a lot of ways. The main way that they changed movies is that, you know, they used to show movies back in the 50s and the 40s with the curtains closed when the credit sequences came up. So the credit sequences of movies actually projected on curtains. But after he did his first credit sequences with Otto Preminger, they actually decided to open the curtains and actually show the credit sequences on the screen, unencumbered for the first time. This created sort of a, well, I need to get there at the beginning of the movie or else I'm going to feel like I missed something, which is something that didn't exist before he had started doing credit sequences. People could easily miss the credit sequences. But now people had to go because it was part of the experience. They had to see the openings. And this was, you know, I mean, after Saul Bass, you know, this was just generally applied to all movies. You know, you had to see the credit sequences, whatever they were.
Well, like Maurice Binder and the Bond movies.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, definitely.
Which is a natural outgrowth of the Saul Bass thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I like Saul Bass's work as a film director of shorts. And it's, you know, you can go on YouTube and find his shorts on YouTube. He did one called Why Man Creates, which is about an 18-minute short that was done in 66, I believe. And it's about the history of creativity. You know, it's just exactly what it sounds like. It's the history of creativity done through not only through animation, which he was a brilliant animator, not just of just abstract, but also of you know, just traditional animation. But also he blended the animation in with live action stuff. And everything that comes out of these movies, this movie and also the Solar film, which he was nominated for an Oscar for, he won an Oscar for Why Man Creates, and later on he directed his one and only feature-length movie, which is called Phase 4, which was about the Earth being taken over by insects.
I remember that. Okay.
Which also has incredible footage in it, in of itself. But I think I like Saul Bass most because he just always, when I see anything that he's done on the big screen, all the way up until Casino and his credit sequences for Casino and Age of Innocence and Cape Fear for Scorsese, I mean, they excite me. They always, always excite me. They always leave me with just like, whoa, I just feel like I ran a half a mile right now. They are just filled with the love of movies and the love of the frame and the love of movement and music with movement. That's another thing. You know, his use of... His being able to collaborate not only with the directors but also with the people who do the scores for the movies. Bernard Herrmann in particular with things like Psycho and North by Northwest. It's just unbelievable perfection. You're just blown away by it. That aside, it's so interesting to know that he is the creator, visually, of so many corporate logos that have infiltrated our lives. I mean, from Quaker Oats to the Girl Scouts to you know, Pan Am and so many others. You know, it's just, it's ridiculous, you know, what an effect this person has had on our lives.
There's this huge coffee table book out of The Art of Saul Bass that I've been wanting to buy. I would imagine it's an extraordinary volume. But I think about it. I think about his opening credit sequences for Scorsese in particular, and I think, you know, that I'm sure he sat down with the director and he talked in terms of the look and the style and the feel of the thing. But more than anything, probably the thematics, you know, the themes that they're dealing with, and to get that in a 2 to 3 minute opening credit sequence, and he often did. And I'm thinking about Age of Innocence and the blooming roses,
the blooming flowers with the script behind them and the lace and everything.
Yeah, or behind the lacy veil, and that's just what that movie is. I mean, it's about these passions that have to be kept just underneath the surface, you know. And then I think of Casino and De Niro's kind of free fall descent into hell. You know, this is a man that controls everything in his life down to the letter. I mean, that's his business. That's his strength. But he cannot control his destiny. It's going to tumble out of control because he falls in love. I mean, essentially, that's the theme and the arc of that character so perfectly articulated in that opening credit sequence. And then I think of his titles and his fonts and his different title designs, like what he did for Kubrick with The Shining. And I read an interview with Bass about The Shining, and he said, look, Kubrick put me through the ringer as no director ever has. He said, I did hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of different title designs for The Shining, and he was so incredibly exacting. And he said, I adored that way of working, that level of specificity. And I finally got it, and it felt like the biggest accomplishment of my life when I reached that finish line. So, I mean, I think that's a very worthy, you know, we don't think of people that work in service of the directors that tell the whole story as being terrific independent storytellers in and of themselves. But Saul Bass is a prime example of someone that definitely is.
Well, yeah, it's the welcoming party, you know, it's the welcoming, it's the thing that gets you hooked, it's the thing, it's like the greeting, if you will, of the movie. And that's the thing that is that can be the make or break, especially in a day, especially the way that we watch movies today and the way the younger generations watch it. I mean, that's really, if they don't like that, boom, they're going to go something else, the next thing or whatever. So, I mean, this is really a unique and really original choice, Dean. I mean, that's a key right there. I mean, that needs to be perfect. And, I mean, those title sequences, you just don't see those that much.
Well,
you don't even see the credit sequences anymore at the beginning of the movies.
I was just going to point that out. You know, the credit sequence is kind of dying, you know. And I feel that that's really a shame because I always felt that the credit sequence was actually sort of the bridge between the world that you're living in, the moment you sit your ass down in the theater, and the world that you're about to enter into. I always felt that it was the bridging sort of thing. It was like, okay, get ready, you know, get ready because you're going to see something amazing here. If the credit sequence is gone, I feel like I'm missing out on a certain sense of value, you know, towards the movie.
Yeah. Well, and also one more thing about Casino, and I haven't read any specific interviews with Scorsese about this, but I know the Vertigo is one of Scorsese's favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the poster design that Bass did for Vertigo, it's quite similar to that opening credit sequence in Casino.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember that poster image.
Yeah, the falling man, falling into the vortex, so to speak, or whatever.
Yeah.
That's another thing about Saul Bass, too. He designed a lot of the posters, you know. In fact, you know, I'm not sure that he designed the credit sequence for The Shining, but he certainly designed the poster and did a lot of work designing that poster. A lot of stuff that was thrown out.
Let me ask you a dumb question. It's a very stupid question, just because I'm not in front of a computer or anything, so I can't cheat. What did he have to do with did he have anything to do with the credits, opening credit sequence on the show Mad Men? Because if not, that's just a complete homage to his work.
But that's a total homage, obviously.
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
okay.
That opening credits thing is absolutely total Saul Bass and absolutely like a tip of the hat to the time period.
Right, okay.
And I'm sure they would say that.
Okay, so we got Tarantino and Saul Bass. My first choice is Robert Altman, because I always thought, I mean, years ago, people were throwing around the word Maverick all over the place. back when what's-his-name was running for president. That used to be the popular slogan. I really do think that when you're talking about cinematic mavericks, I think Robert Altman is the epitome of such a thing. I think his kind of uncompromising point of view as a director, his ability to work with large casts, get them in front of the camera lens, and just let them be free and see what life transpired in the process, his willingness to be surprised and his ability to accommodate surprise. Sometimes it would the film itself would not work, but it would always make for a fascinating experiment. And when it did work, his movies felt alive and alert and vivid in a way that made him very unique. And I mean, obviously you can talk about Nashville and you can talk about MASH and Shortcuts and The Player. And I with Altman, I always go back to McCabe and Mrs. Miller, because I personally am not – a fan of Westerns necessarily. They're not the first go-to genre I get excited about. But McCabe and Mrs. Miller, you feel the life of that town because the way he directed the film, he had the town built as they were shooting. So the settlement was coming to life as the movie was going on. And they were all living together. They formed a community, that film crew and all the actors. And you feel that in the movie. And it's about incredibly interesting characters, like this completely helpless, slightly dim-witted dreamer that Warren Beatty plays, and this ephemeral beauty that Julie Christie plays, and the melancholy kind of sadness of their destiny.
I never did fit in this goddamn town. God, I hate when them bastards put their hands on you. I tell you, sometimes when I take a look at you, I just keep looking and looking. So I won't feel your little body up against me so bad, I think I'm gonna bust. I keep trying to tell you in a lot of different ways. Just one time you can be sweet without no money around. I think I could. Well, I'll tell you something, I got poetry in me. I do, I got poetry in me, but I ain't gonna put it down on paper. I ain't no educated man. I got sense enough not to try it.
Who would have thought that Robert Altman would have staged an incredibly exciting gun battle? It's the last thing I expected from an Altman film. But, you know, we're living in this environment with these people, and it's very, very vivid environment. And he closes it off, you know, in classic Western form with a gunfight. And it's,
right.
it's an exciting
one. In the snow.
Yes.
The snow, which makes it different. He's always looking for a different angle, you know, to do things from.
And I loved his daring. I mean, his daring to flash the negative and give McCabe that very special look.
Mm-hmm.
He had an incredible daring. Of course, his DP on that was Wilmer Siegmund, who was also eager to be daring. And I loved his love of actors. I mean, typically, Warren Beatty excluded, because Warren Beatty, I think Warren Beatty is just a control freak on his films. And Altman was an auteur, and his sense of control over McCabe and Mrs. Miller was kind of out of his hands, and he had a hard time getting accustomed to that. But his love of actors, how much actors loved and adored him, because he gave them such a freedom to create and explore and find their joy in those characters. And I loved his I don't give a shit attitude. That
he would
not be told what any part of his movie had to be. He would not be dictated anything by the studio powers that be.
Yeah.
I mean, he was his own. I mean, unmistakable. All of these directors that we're going to talk about tonight, I guarantee, you cannot confuse their work with anyone else.
Right, that's true. But Altman is such a special case because there are so many films. There's such a wealth of work. I mean, just towards the end, I'm just thinking Kansas City, Cookie's Fortune, Gingerbread Man, Gosford Park was just another one that was just really well done. Classic Altman, The Company, Dr. T and the Women, not all these work, but they were, how should I say, you were never bored. I don't think you were ever bored during the Altman film, even Popeye, which I think is the first film I saw by him.
Well, essentially, if you love performance, if you love the process of seeing an actor perform, I don't think you can be bored by an Altman film.
No.
They're
so packed with people. I mean, every single Altman film is ridiculously packed with so many people.
And the stage plays that he converted to film. I mean, starting with Secret Honor, which really catapulted Philip Baker Hall to the forefront.
just a one-person show there. But
yes.
Don't forget Tanner 88.
Tanner 88. I mean, which is really like the precursor to a lot of the best cable programming we see today.
Yeah.
I mean,
isn't California Split? California Split. Him too,
yes.
Isn't it, Altman?
Yes.
That's an awesome show. Yep. The Chandler one, The Long Goodbye.
Or his
like dreamy movies. He did a couple of like very dreamy, crazy movies that he actually said came from dreams, like Images.
Yeah. Images.
The Long Goodbye is so good.
The Long Goodbye is a great example of how experimental he could be within kind of a classical structure, because you can't get more classically structured than the old style Philip Marlowe detective story. You know,
right?
He took that. He made the Philip Marlowe character Elliot Gould, which is not your what you view as your suave Humphrey Bogart.
That's not the first. Guy, you think I'm going to play Philip Marlowe? No matter what decade.
but also experimental, right down to the music for The Long Goodbye, because the only music that accompanies that movie is that single theme for The Long Goodbye, and John Williams did like a dozen versions of that theme for all these different situations, and it plays on the speakers, and when he walks into the supermarket, it's kind of a Muzak version. Lou Rawls sings it as a pop song at the beginning of the movie. I mean, he was endlessly experimental in a number of ways. And talking about how he worked with actors, this is why great actors gravitated towards him, because they felt inspired like no one else. Kenneth Branagh was telling a story about working with him on The Gingerbread Man. And he said that there was one scene where he was walking from like point A to point B through crowds and such, and he ended up in a house or something. It was a simple scene, but Altman didn't really give him much of a direction. He just said, "Walk here to here," and these people, you'll encounter these people along the way, blah blah blah. Just do whatever feels right.
Right.
And so Kenneth Branagh, it was completely foreign to him, because there wasn't any kind of specificity in the direction. And he says, "Well, can you tell me anything that I can possibly expect?" And he said, "Yeah, eventually, when you reach your destination, a phone is going to ring. Pick it up." You know, and it was that kind of, let's see what this actor can do. And if the actor is in the moment, I mean, he truly... His approach really forced actors to live in the moment, because that's all there was.
But let's not forget too, just in case we, you know, want to pigeonhole, make the mistake of pigeonholing Altman as just an actor's director. He was also much more than that. He was a visual director.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at an Altman film for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and you know anything about movies, you will know immediately that this is an Altman film. I don't care which one it is, because he is constantly, his camera is constantly busy in almost every one of his movies. There are pans, tilts, zooms, focus, rack focusing. There's all sorts of little tricks that he does to keep the visual interesting, even during extremely long takes. Those extremely long takes help the actors, yes. But his way of acting behind the camera, because he was an actor too, you know, but just with the camera, he was able to keep everything incredibly interesting, even with extremely long takes. Plus, his use of music in movies is almost always interesting.
Well,
Leonard
Cohen
Popeye,
and McCabe.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen
stuff in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Or the John Williams score with the Japanese percussionist in Images. Or all that stuff in Nashville. Or his last movie, Prairie Home Companion. Right.
He never shied away from having music be an important component of his movies. He was really just a great all-around filmmaker. And if I'm going to be perfectly honest, I would count him among my, you know, I'm not talking about my five favorite filmmakers on this show, my five very favorite filmmakers of this show, but he is one of the five.
Yeah. I mean, the camera never stops moving in The Long Goodbye. I'm not sure that if there's a static shot in that movie. And he had a signature shot for a while where he would dolly and zoom at the same time. And he employed that a lot, especially The Long Goodbye. But if you think of the very specific look of McCabe and Mrs. Miller, if you think, who would have thought that a Leonard Cohen soundtrack would work in McCabe and Mrs. Miller? But that's a large percentage of that movie's power.
That just perfect choice of what that sense of melancholy that those mm-hmm. songs have is just perfect. It's just like when that first frame of McCabe and Mrs. Miller pops up with that music on it, you just absolutely know that you're going to see something special.
And I'll close off with Altman by saying this: it is a travesty that he is not better represented on Blu-ray. I mean, you've got the Criterion title, the Three Women, and you've got MASH. And I'm not sure what else of his is on Blu-ray, actually. You know?
Yeah, that's a good,
sounds
that's
like
a good,
box
very good point.
To me.
it needs to be. It needs to be. And Criterion came out with the DVDs of Shortcuts.
Yeah, I have that.
They need to transfer that to Blu-ray. I mean, he needs to be better represented on this format, especially a gorgeous-looking movie like
McCabe and Mrs. Miller definitely needs to be on Blu-ray.
Oh, God.
Let alone DVD. It's not even on DVD, is it?
It's hard to find. You can get it, like, on Netflix. It's out of print. I'm sure you could buy a copy on Amazon somehow. But okay, Jerry, give me another one of yours.
Let's go ahead with Francis Ford Coppola. The next four basically made me want to pick up a camera, if anybody. But Coppola, at first, you know, it's obviously the Godfather movies, all three of them. But obviously, watching those two in high school in the summer with my mom, and then watching the second one with my dad, which was quite an experience, which I don't know if I can recommend it or not, but watching those on video, it was really interesting because video was still, this was 85 or 86, and renting movies was still kind of a novel thing, not as something that, I mean, it was something we did, but not it did as it became more and more commonplace, you know, as the years went on, but it was still, it's not something I did every week or something. But I remember watching these that summer in high school, and they just blew me away. I mean, this is really about family and what it means to, and why that's important and everything. But it was just, you got so engrossed in the characters. I mean, I always heard about these movies growing up. I never watched them. And I had seen Apocalypse Now like a couple of times, like years before that, but Apocalypse Now didn't really become important until the end of high school. Coppola is one of my favorite interviews that we've done on the whole show. I find him fascinating because he's always trying to reinvent himself, whether it's as a winemaker or as a magazine or the hotels or as an independent filmmaker. He's a fascinating man, but he really identifies, I think, very strongly with his characters, especially in Michael. I think he identifies 100% with Michael Corleone. I don't think there's any doubt after watching the third one. But I just, he's a larger-than-life persona, and his movies and The Conversation, I know that I think, I agree with you, Jamie, that's an incredible movie. There's a couple scenes in that movie I just think about every day. Like, I'll see I'm in The Conversation. I'll just pinpoint. So, you know, you do that with movies. You'll see, you know, just like images. That's The Conversation I do that with. But I think Apocalypse Now is one of the two greatest adventures ever put on screen. I think it is not the Redux is interesting, but you don't need that. You don't need any of that excess footage. There's a reason that was cut out, and because it's a completely different movie in one sense when you. But I think Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, when you add the humor in and stuff like that, and just when you add the humor into it with the whole, you know, Colonel with the whole, you know, Robert Duvall sequence with stealing the surfboard and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you don't need that. It takes away some of his mystique because he's just got he's so nuts in that. I mean, it's like the precursor to the Great Santini. You know, it's like the prequel to the Great Santini almost.
Well, you could imagine that character being out of wartime. And and turning into the Great Santini, and you even feel it in Apocalypse Now, when the most famous scene, the I love the smell of napalm in the morning, and when that monologue ends, Duvall's line is, "One day this war is going to end."
expecting another line.
you would think that if that line were written in any other movie, it would be kind of a hopeful thing. It's like, my God,
right.
I just have to keep telling myself one day this war is going to end. When he says it, it's wistful because you know he's going to miss it.
He's going to miss it.
What the hell is that character going to do without the war?
The baseball bat is for playing baseball, not hitting your kids with. Oh, no. But here's a guy who was like on the cutting edge. You know, we always talk about Lucas and everything, but it's really, I think Coppola was one of the most cutting edge directors, and maybe he still isn't in one sense, but he always seemed to be ahead of the curve, technology wise. There, just as De Palma was too. It's just
well, he really was on ahead of the curve. I mean, and you look at stuff like Rumblefish and that period of time in the early 80s and One from the Heart, which I think he was the first person to kind of put together a mobile editing unit.
Yeah,
I mean, he had it there,
right?
Yeah, there in his van. Yeah, exactly. When I think of Coppola, I think of the great he is the great dramatist in the classical sense. And you said that, without a doubt, he identifies with Michael. I think he identifies just as strongly with the Willard and in Apocalypse Now, and I think you can see that in that documentary. He is Willard in that movie. He has taken this journey, this journey into an unknown hell, and his challenge is, can I slay this thing and come out on the other side? I mean, just like Willard, can I survive this movie?
Do you remember back when the movie was coming out you'd heard so much about it for years? And just going to see it, and especially, of course, first on your mind was, okay, when I was first sitting down for that movie, I was like, okay, I'm interested in seeing Brando because this is what I've heard about this. But it didn't take more than 10 minutes of that movie to go by, maybe even 5 minutes, with that incredible opening sequence that uses Walter Murch's editing and sound work in that incredible opening sequence that just made you, in 5 minutes, forget that Brando was even in this movie. And then by the time you're reminded, hey, he's in it, he's coming, you know. And then finally, when it gets there, you know, the reviews were so savage about the ending of the film. But now when you go and watch it, you're like, what were they complaining about? And I remember sitting in the theater going, this is just fine. This is more than fine. It's brilliant.
What did they tell you? They told me that you had gone totally insane. And that your methods were unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
I don't see any method at all.
Mm-hmm. That's what you want in that character. You want absolute, utter craziness. Or
well, because
well, yeah.
you've
you
already
know?
Lived. You've already lived with it for 2 hours. So Brando is
yeah.
The culmination of that craziness.
Yeah, I mean,
that you've,
yeah.
that you've already been in the presence of. You know.
I mean, if you want to see all Brando, just watch the opening of Superman. You get to see plenty of them. I mean,
right.
you know, that big aluminum foil outfit.
He is the false deity. I mean, he's the guy that believes his own kind of deluded sense of self. I mean,
and
I don't see how that movie could have ended any other way. Of course, that's how the movie ends. When I ask people, how would you want it to end? Strangely enough, none of them can give me an answer. But somehow they all say it just had a bad ending. No, it ended the way.
What is it? I mean, it's perfect. It's almost like the Wizard of Oz. You pull the curtain back. When you pull the curtain, when you finally do meet Kurt, it is just diluted man, American power unchecked, spoiled, rotten. In love with a note. What G.D. Sparling says at the beginning, operating without any control.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the journey that Martin Sheen could find himself on. He is at that precipice after he slays Marlon Brando and he walks out and all the tribesmen are looking up at him.
Mm-hmm.
He could be Brando. He could assume that role, and he chooses not to. He walks away. That's the perfect ending.
One of the things I want to say about Coppola is, you know, okay, there's Apocalypse Now, but with all of his movies, there's a certain different sort of flavor of storytelling going on
mm-hmm.
in just about every one of his greatest movies. I mean, he's had some movies that didn't work, no question about it. But
right.
If you go back into things like, you know, You're a Big Boy Now, with that
mm-hmm.
sort of 60s mentality that's going on in it, very youthful kind of devil may care kind of thing that's going on
right.
in that. And then in something like The Rain People, that was done with Shirley Knight in the lead,
mm-hmm.
which was
mm-hmm.
an early sort of... call for, you know, women's rights, or at least a female freedom, you know, or at least a sense of breaking away from, you know, the traditional female roles. And then you go into The Godfather, which the Godfather series, just in general, is just incredible, epic storytelling that's just so involving that you just feel like you're just falling into a hole while you're watching those movies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you take a look at something like The Conversation, which is really a movie about loneliness, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a movie about loneliness and solitude in a lot of ways. And then you go to something like, you know, to jump further in his career, to something like Tucker, The Man in His Dream.
That's a good movie. I like that movie a lot.
Which is ridiculously fun, even
mm-hmm.
though it should be a dark movie about how somebody was, an entrepreneur was crushed by the bigger companies and so forth and so on. It doesn't have any of that feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
It has the feel of, hey, look, I accomplished something. I accomplished what I set out to do. That character accomplished what he set out to do, and he did it with joy and aplomb, at least according
mm-hmm.
to the movie. And,
right.
And you really get that, you know. You really come out of that. I think Tucker was one of his greatest movies, you know.
It's a great movie. It's a very good movie.
It is. I mean, it's something that everybody should go back and look at just as much as they go back and look at the more famous titles of his career. But
and
right.
you mentioned something about him being not all of the movies being great, and I think that's pretty much indicative of a lot of the directors that we're probably going to be discussing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because these directors, the best directors, risk big.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with that kind of approach, you can win big or you could fall big. But at
mm-hmm.
least you're reaching and you're risking. And I think that's
mm-hmm.
the true test of a great artist. I mean, not
right.
all of Dracula works. But
right, but when it does, it's
incredibly experimental and risky and out there. And then he could go. Then he could go and he could do a more classically structured piece like The Rainmaker, something that just exists for the joy of storytelling and the joy of being in the company of enjoyable actors. And that's the best Grisham movie there is.
Oh, yes. I agree 100% with you.
That's absolutely true. And then look at like his early 80s stuff with things like One from the Heart. I mean, a ridiculously different kind of movie. And maybe his only movie that has music as a really, really central component, I mean, to the point where people are singing on screen. And then going into things like The Outsiders and Rumblefish, which were so concerned with youthful sort of rebellion, you know, and but not making it so that it was, you know, they're obviously influenced by things like Rebel Without a Cause and so forth, but they have a certain visual. They have both of those movies, especially the Coppola, the director's cut of Outsiders, by the way, is great. I mean, that's one of the great director's cuts that's out there, because he really totally reinvented the movie, with music, and he kind of jettisoned a lot of the score that his own father did for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And replace it with, you know, period songs, and it actually makes the movie pop a lot more. But those two movies are just incredible visual treats, you know, like just beautiful, and beautiful also ensemble cast in many of his movies. I mean, all of his movies are just ridiculous ensemble casts that just blow you away.
Yeah.
No, I agree. Yeah.
Okay, another exciting choice. See, that sparked a great, passionate conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So good, good choice. Dean, what's your next one?
My next one is a filmmaker that only had an output of five, let's see, one, two, three, four, five movies. He only worked from 1969 to 1983, and his name is Bob Fosse.
Oh.
For me,
I've been thinking a lot about Bob Fosse lately, actually.
Bob Fosse, to me, is just such an amazing, amazing filmmaker. First of all, let's get out of the way the fact that since the 50s, he had been an actor in movies, in such movies as Kiss Me, Kate and Damn Yankees. He had been a dancer in those same movies and even a singer in those movies as well. But he was also mainly known for being a stage director. By the end of his career, he had won a record six Tonys for choreography on the stage. And he had won. He's also one of the few filmmakers, maybe the only filmmaker, that has won an Emmy, an Oscar, and a Tony in the same year, which was 72.
Wow.
So that's pretty amazing, too. Okay, so he was an actor. He was a dancer. He was a choreographer. He was a writer. He was a director. He had all of these amazing abilities, and, you know, that alone, like, puts him, you know, in my heart. It's like just being, well, this is just a one-of-a-kind person, you know, this is just a one-of-a-kind. You're never going to see the likes of Bob Fosse ever again. But in addition, when you look at even something that he didn't direct, like, let's take, for instance, Chicago, which was something that he had directed on stage. Or you look at something like, you know, years ago, it's probably hard to find now, but there used to be a very popular tape on the video store shelves that was a videotaped version of his production of Pippin, which starred Ben Vereen in the production that was videotaped, at least. It starred Ben Vereen and William Catt in the lead role.
William Catt, wow, okay.
Yeah. When you look at, or you look at something like Dancing, which was something that he had, which was sort of like a compilation of all of his choreographed work for the stage, that was done as a stage play in the mid-70s. Then later on, of course, there was the stage play Fosse. When you look at any of Fosse's dancing, let's just forget about the film work. When you look at any of Fosse's dancing, stuff that he created for the dancers that he loved and worked with, it's absolutely unmistakable that that is his work. I defy you to name another choreographer that you just see their work and you just absolutely know that's them. Okay, so, okay, that aside, stage work aside, when you look at the film work of Bob Fosse, the quality of the photography, the sort of weird, sort of sideways staginess of the photography, the crispness of the editing, the sort of strange mixture of love and revulsion for the entire show business industry that he has. The sort of the rapport that he seems to have with actors, the sort of uncompromising and even often vulgar writing that he does. I mean, all of these things mixed together, and it's just like you're just never going to see another person that has this ever again. You know, you're just not going to see it.
Yeah, and you said that the kind of the balance between the the empathy and the revulsion of his characters, and I mean, I sense that in a lot of what he did. I mean, and you, of course, all that jazz is very autobiographical, and it's very honest about who Fosse is and what his faults were. And then you look at Star 80, and you look at Eric Roberts' portrayal of Paul Snyder in Star 80, and you could tell this is someone that Fosse empathizes with, even though obviously his behavior is repellent. And it doesn't shy away from that. I mean, when I think of Fosse, that's the characteristic I most think of. He doesn't shy away from from his subjects, foibles and all. You know, he did Sweet Charity. That was his debut film in 69, and that was not a success. And so it wasn't a sure thing to bring him on to direct Cabaret. But it's interesting how, Jerry, you just chose Francis Ford Coppola, and Bob Fosse actually beat Francis Ford Coppola for the Best Director Oscar the year The Godfather came out for Cabaret. So these two are connected in a certain that peripheral way.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Cabaret. I love all that jazz. I think all that jazz is an extraordinarily raw movie. And Star 80 is incredibly powerful. I'm not so crazy about Lenny.
Yeah, really? I mean, I feel Lenny is a very, very... Well, first of all, one of the things I love about Lenny, which is something that he sort of repeated in Star 80, is sort of the quasi-documentary sort of framing that both of those movies have.
Right.
Where, you know, a lot of the characters are sort of narrating the movie as if they're talking in a documentary to an unseen filmmaker. And I really love Lenny for reproducing the time period, first of all, but also for his ability to dramatize a person that was hard to understand, I think. He was a difficult person to really get a hold of because of his drug addiction, but also because of how beset he was by the court, you know.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, Lenny Bruce in the movie and in real life actually lost his identity because he was no longer a comedian. He was now a person who was fighting for a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And even a cause that he didn't truly understand. I think Lenny might be, I like Sweet Charity just for entertainment value and everything
right.
like that. I mean, it's a good entertaining, not a great movie, but and so I really concentrate my love for his work on his last four movies, and particularly on All That Jazz, which I consider to be like absolutely one of the greatest movies that's ever been made. I can just remember going to see All That Jazz. I saw it maybe three times in the first week that I had been exposed to it. I was like, this is unbelievable. I've got to go see it again. I could not make myself sit in a chair long enough for me to go, I've got to go see it. It's right down the street. I have to go see it again. it's too incredible. In all of his movies too, of course, the mixture of music and just that and the editing. I mean, the editing in his movies is just ridiculous. I just can't get over it. I can't even put words to it.
Very much.
It's just beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I do think that all that jazz is his masterpiece.
It is.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Why isn't that on Blu-ray? I mean, that's not on Blu-ray yet.
Yeah, that's a crime. But I mean, you know, if there's anything out there, and I always suspect that there's certain element to Bob Fosse movies that's keeping people from watching them because they just don't think it's that their kind of movie. I remember being at a video store. You know, I used to work at a video store, and people would come in, and I knew what their tastes were like. You know, they liked Taxi Driver and so forth. I said, you need to watch this, All That Jazz. Well, it has people on the cover, women on the cover of it that are dressed in dancer tights and stuff like that with their hats on and everything. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. I don't think I want to watch that. You know what? Forget all that stuff. Just watch the movie. Believe me, when you come out of that movie, if you just don't have any kind of appreciation for it, then I just don't know what to say. Because I'm without any kind of words to say.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It's interesting to me how, with All That Jazz, I mean, obviously he was looking for an actor to play his surrogate in the lead, and that Richard Dreyfuss was brought on, and he worked with him for a couple of weeks, and then he dropped out. He just wasn't right for it. And then Roy Scheider, who had no background in the musical, I don't think. I mean, he was really out of his element. And honestly, Roy Scheider's performance in that is incredible.
That's true.
Amazing.
It is. It is ridiculously first of all, has any director ever made a movie as autobiographical to the point where they predict their own death?
And he came to believe that work, show business, love, his whole life, even himself and all that jazz, was bullshit. He became numero uno game player to the point where he didn't know where the games ended and the reality began. Like this cat, the only reality is death, man. Ladies and gentlemen, Let me lay on you. A so-so entertainer, not much of a humanitarian, and this cat was never nobody's friend. In his final appearance on the great stage of life, you can applaud if you wanna, Mr. Joe Gideon.
You want to look away at times. Yeah.
Right.
It is. It's ridiculous. And then, but has on top of that, has any other actor ever sort of usurped their director's personality more than Roy Scheider did with Bob Fosse? I don't think there is. I can't think of one. It's fun to know that he had such a small output, but not one of those movies is something you should just toss off and just say, yeah, I don't need to watch that.
No.
But it's a rare filmmaker that you can say everything they did was good. So
right.
He had the directorial career equivalent of John Cazale.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You're right. I just saw a shooting star.
Wow!
I just saw a shooting star. I haven't seen one. Not like that. I've never seen one that close. That was okay.
It's a magical night, Jerry.
It's a magical night. Yeah. Bob Fosse and a shooting star.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If I started a band, that's exactly what I'd call it.
That's a great band name.
Yeah,
Bob
Fosse like,
and
it's
the
like
Shooting Star.
My version of Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet. That's yeah. Okay, my second choice is one of the most distinctive filmmakers of the past 30 years, and or longer, actually, going on 35 years, I think. And I'm talking about David Lynch. What is unique about David Lynch is that truly, I mean, he's made, I don't know how many films, I'd have to go back and count, but I count three of his films among my personal favorites.
Mm-hmm.
The others are kind of a mixed bag for me. But I'm so passionate about these three movies that I just devour them. They're a part of me. And those three movies are Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, and Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me. I always equate him with being a stream of consciousness filmmaker because he always talks about ideas and how magical it is when an idea happens upon you and you build upon it with another morsel and another idea and blah, 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 and it forms into this living thing. I like his approach to the creative process that way. And I was reading...
Sure.
I have a revised first draft of his Wild at Heart script. He wrote Wild at Heart, I think, in like 2 weeks. It was the fastest he ever finished a screenplay, he said. And at least the first draft that I have, it's very sloppy in places. But you know the scene in the New Orleans restaurant. There's Sailor and Lula are sitting at the bar, and there's a man sitting beside them.
Mm-hmm.
That just looks at them and he says in the strange, strained voice, he says, "Pigeons spread diseases and mess up the place. You see that?"
That's all
that character says in the movie. Well, David Lynch wrote like a 4-page monologue for this guy. And
mm-hmm.
he talked about his background and how much he hates pigeons and how he used to kill pigeons in his neighborhood. He used to stand up on the rooftop with a rifle and shoot them. And some passerby saw him and called the cops on him. They thought he was some kind of assassin or marksman or something, and he was a danger. This is like a 76-year-old man. He goes through this whole story, and then Sailor's like, why don't you like pigeons? And then one of his lines of dialogue in his response is that line, pigeons spread diseases and mess up the place. You see that. And all David Lynch did, I mean, was he took that one line, and that's that gentleman's performance in that movie.
Right.
And
okay.
It's a very strange, unique, memorable, like unforgettable moment. Just because it kind of it comes out of nowhere. But I think that in his creative process, he had to write those four pages of dialogue
in order to just get that one line.
to get that one moment, to kind of work it out in his mind. And I'm wondering, mm-hmm. what did he shoot those four pages? And he just happened to, he just said, let's just simplify this. Let's make this really memorable. Let's just have him say that one thing and then walk away. You know? And that makes the scene really pop. What's very special about Wild at Heart to me is the fact that Sailor and Lula are the most iconic romantic couple in modern movies for me.
Mm-hmm.
Their innocence, they're highly sexual, they're rebellious, their love exists in the midst of great danger and oppression, but it shines through. It's the kind of love that we feel when we fall in love for the first time. And
right.
We think that we're invincible and nothing could ever destroy it. And then you grow up and life happens and you get jaded,
mm-hmm.
and you drift apart but when I think about that kind of evolution or de-evolution of a relationship, I always think back on Sailor and Lula. I say, but there's always the hope that you could have a Sailor and Lula kind of love, you know,
right.
that you could hold on to that, and that's something that's the thing that I respond to most in David Lynch. It's the contrast, and it's never more apparent for me than it is in Wild at Heart. Between obviously the light and the dark, but between love and death, between life and decay, it's so visceral the way he expresses the extreme contrasts in life.
Mm-hmm. I always admired your take on Wild at Heart, because I know that movie means a lot to you. It's a very good movie. But we talk about Lynch. I've never asked you though. What do you think of The Straight Story?
I like The Straight Story. I think it has the perfect title, because that's mm-hmm. the straightest story as he's ever told.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I like it. There is as in all of his movies, a definite sense of environment and place and tone, and at the same time, it's slightly off kilter. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's his version of a family-friendly movie,
right?
But it's actually it's a man that goes on a quest on a tractor, and he encounters different people and different kinds of mm-hmm. kinds of adventures in a certain
right.
way, weirdness here and there. So it's not in its form. It's not totally unlike a Wild at Heart necessarily, which is also a road movie of a kind.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
I like it very much, but it kind of mutes his what makes him so distinctive for me.
I would venture to disagree there. I think The Straight Story is as Lynchian a movie as all of the rest of them are, but it's in a very secretive sort of. Well, it's in a very secretive way. I mean,
mm-hmm.
what we're dealing with in Straight Story is an elderly man with a past that we don't know specifically what it is. Okay.
Right.
He's got a past. Look, he's got. He says early on in the movie that he has a lot of children, but there's only one child that's left behind to take care of him, and it's presumably, well, the most infirm child that they had, that he and his wife had. His wife has passed away, and who's left behind? Sissy Spacek plays a daughter that has a speech impediment, and perhaps could be considered a little slow. But it takes a little while for you to figure out that he actually has a lot more children that are not in his life. Well, what's the reason for that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, secondly, he also lets you know, we also know that he's had a falling out. This is the whole reason for his going across country. his whole reason for going across country is that he's had a falling out with his brother. We don't know what the falling out is, but we know that it was big enough to destroy their relationship. And now he's gotten word that his brother is dying, and he feels that he has to go and repair that relationship, even at this late date. Okay? Even if it takes him to take a riding lawnmower across country to do it, he's going to do it. As the movie progresses, and he meets a lot of the people that he meets along the way, we find out little bitty pieces of the sort of perhaps the unpleasant person that he was in the past. Now he's an older man, and he's got perspective on things, but that's not the man that he was. What I'm saying here is that The Straight Story is a movie about a guy that has a dark past.
Right.
But we don't know that past, and the director's interesting choice is that he chooses not to dramatize that past at all, except through what the man is experiencing in the present. There's no flashbacks.
Right.
None of that stuff. That's the brilliance of that movie.
I think so, but for people that don't like Lynch, that don't respond to his particular brand of ambiguous weirdness, Straight Story is the movie for him. And I do think among his catalog, it is his straightest story, because all the unanswered questions you just mentioned, you don't need to know those, the
All
answers
right.
to those. In a lot of Lynch's movies, but particularly I find in Fire Walk With Me, great sections of Fire Walk With Me, it's not that they're unanswered questions. You don't even know the question. I mean, you're like, what the hell is going on? That whole David Bowie segment.
Gordon! 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 Philip! Is that you? Philip? Cooper, meet the long-lost Philip Jeffries. You may have heard of him from the Academy.
Well, now, I'm not going to talk about Judy. In fact, we're not going to talk about Judy at all. We're going to keep her out of it.
Gordon?
I know, Coop.
Who do you think this is there?
Suffered some bumps in the old noggin himself.
What the hell did he say there, Albert? That's Special Agent Dale Cooper. For God's sake, Jeffries, where the hell have you been? You've been gone damn near 2 years.
I'm sorry, I don't want to tell you everything.
Of the show, watching that movie, Twin Peaks, watching that movie, you're like, okay, now what's going on here?
and the movie is a different experience from the show. And I do think that the movie is Lynch's full-out horror film. And
right.
I do feel like, again, there is such a tremendous love and compassion for Laura Palmer in the movie. And
right.
Such a heartfelt pain for what she's going through. And yet Lynch does not look away. I mean, he faces the horror of it. And somehow when Laura reaches her end, she finally reaches her salvation. She's finally free of this albatross. So there's that, and there's the amazing, amazing performance of Cheryl Lee in the film. And there's also that. There's these deleted scenes. Apparently there's like 40 some odd minutes of deleted footage. It was written in the script and much of it was shot. And there's this big campaign, find the deleted footage from Fire Walk With Me and either reinstate it in the movie or put it on the Blu-ray when that comes out. And
right.
Lynch and Robert Ingalls, the screenwriter, they've said that this footage exists somewhere. We're close to finding it. I mean, this has been going on for years. It got tied up in like the studio went under or something. They didn't know what happened to the footage, and then they tracked it down. I don't want them to put the footage back, because apparently most of the footage, it has stuff that goes to like a different country. It's got more comical stuff. Lynch even said that if that footage would have ended up in the movie, it would have been a much lighter movie than what you have now.
Right.
I like Fire Walk With Me because it's a completely dark experience, as it should be. It's about the trauma of a girl who's being raped by her father.
Right.
And that downward spiral into hell.
Let's just face it, it's the culmination of a show that captured the world's imagination for 2 or 3 years. And it still remains, Twin Peaks still remains possibly the most influential show of the past 30 years, I would say.
I feel like
without Twin Peaks, I definitely feel like you wouldn't have The Sopranos. And
you wouldn't have The Sopranos. You wouldn't have The X-Files. I don't think you would have.
And I don't think you would have Mad Men either.
Twin Peaks really revitalized, did something to TV. David Lynch did something to TV. But it's interesting you bring up Lynch, because I think we had talked about this before. I would love Lynch to make one, or just another movie. And a real movie, not something that's just almost verges on like painful self-parody, like Inland Empire. Something really substantial. I can't go back and watch Inland Empire. It was hard enough to watch the first time, I think. I mean,
I have a tremendous love for Inland Empire too. I mean, you know, I'm going to be quite honest here. You know, Jamie, you picked Altman. And I said that he would be one of my top five filmmakers if I was just going to go and say my top five filmmakers of all time. Altman would be in the top five, and Lynch would be in the top five too. I mean, to me, what's the most amazing to me about Lynch is his realization that watching movies is only a hair's breadth away from going to sleep and dreaming.
True.
His movies are about dreams, I think. And I mean, I think this speaks to, you know, one of the reasons that David Lynch has sort of dropped out of the filmmaking thing, you know, it seems like he's absent from filmmaking these days. Although he has done stuff online. He did a huge documentary thing that's online that was going around interviewing just normal people across the nation.
Yeah, I love that series.
So he's still in there making films, but I think he's forward thinking. You know, I think that he's trying to incorporate, you know, the newer modes of filmmaking into his mind. But also, let's don't forget that one of his big causes these days is transcendental meditation.
Right.
And he's trying to get schools to teach transcendental meditation to their students. And I think that's something that's captured his imagination a little bit more. Now, why has that captured his imagination? Because he realizes that in the process of transcendental meditation, which is something like lucid dreaming, and it can be seen as something like lucid dreaming, he feels that people can get a greater clarity about their own lives. Well, this is exactly what he feels about filmmaking. He feels that filmmaking is sort of like the watching of movies is sort of like a lucid dream. And the watching of movies actually creates a state in people's minds in which they are open to revelations about their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the most, possibly the most amazing thing about him. I don't think that there's another filmmaker out there that you can say that they trade in this. I mean, they might touch on it sometimes, but do they trade in it? No. This is what David Lynch does.
Right.
He creates living dreams in front of us. And let me just go back early in his career, his first movie, which remains my favorite movie of his, and it was also Stanley Kubrick's. You know, Stanley Kubrick loved this movie. And even David Lynch in a recent book says, you know, I found out that he loved Eraserhead and wanted to screen it again and again. And that's one of the greatest compliments I've ever gotten, was that Kubrick loved Eraserhead. Well, I find Eraserhead to be his true masterpiece. The work that went into Eraserhead is absolutely astounding. That guy worked on that movie from 1972 to 1977.
Mm-hmm.
He actually delivered, David Lynch actually had no budget for this movie. He was lucky to get some kind of hobble in the back of the AFI Film Institute to go and film scenes from this movie. And he did it over 5 years with a very dedicated crew of actors and technicians. He went through two cinematographers, one of which died during the process of the movie. He hand-painted every single tile that you see in the movie on the floors. He designed every single piece of, and this is not something that he did for just this movie. He did it all the way up to the present. He designed every piece of furniture, every single thing that you see in the frame of a David Lynch movie is something that he put there. He insisted on it. Every single thing that's in the frame.
Yeah, there's a story that Laura Dern told about Wild at Heart, and they were in the hotel set, and Lynch said, "I think that nightstand needs a lamp. Let me make one real quick." And he went off and he made a lamp. And like an hour later, he comes back and just puts it down and says, "Okay, we're ready to go."
That's ridiculous. Name another director that does that. No,
yeah.
There isn't one. But let me just talk about Eraserhead for a second. Eraserhead is just one of the most amazing, like, sort of like otherworldly movies that's ever been made. Every single bit of it, every frame, every sound that appears through Alan Splett's amazing sound design is just extraordinary. And the fact that it was filmed over 5 years with David Lynch having to deliver newspapers in order to finance the movie. And he had a child on the way, and the movie's about his fears of being a father and everything. So the movie is, even in some sense, just as autobiographical as all that jazz was. You know, what's interesting, I think the connective tissue in all of these film directors that we're talking about right now is that their lives are almost indistinguishable from their movies. There is no point in each one of these filmmakers that we've talked about, Tarantino all the way up to Lynch,
mm-hmm.
their lives are almost indistinguishable from the movies that they produce.
But with Lynch, and I'll say one last thing about the contrasts of Lynch, and I do think that's the distinguishing factor for me in all of his work, is that the contrast, and this echoes what you just said, Dean, the contrast exists in the man. I mean, with David Lynch, you have a dirty Boy Scout, and you have the guy that says okie dokie, you know, and solid gold after it gives a good take. You have the guy that cracks up behind the camera during the Dennis Hopper rape scene in Blue Velvet because he's just giddy about how over the top it is. You know, he finds it funny. Yeah, so I mean, you have this extremely like polished, polite, all-American exterior with this really naughty, naughty person underneath. And, and I love that. I mean, it's delectable. It makes for great cinema.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night, softer than satin was the light from the stars. She wore warmer than May, her tender sighs. Love was ours, ours, love I held tightly, feeling the rapture grow. Gone was the glow of blue velvet, but in my heart they'll always be precious and warm, a memory through the years. And I still can see blue velvet my tears. She wore blue velvet, but in my heart they'll always be precious and warm, a memory through the years.